doing, it inspires others to drop into that level themselves. Jonah listened with rapt attention, and when he spoke, it was to say in a hushed voice, "I never realized how much that meant to you. Whenever that subject came up, I just heard it as criticism." I summarized it this way. I said to them, "You felt attracted to the young man because you were connecting with him on an emotional level. You really want that kind of connection with Jonah, but you despair of ever getting it. If you don't get that, you're going to fail to accomplish one of your life's biggest goals. That's big stuff. No wonder you started accusing Jonah of being attracted to a couple of the young women on your staff." She nodded in agreement. Jonah leaned forward and said, "To be fair, I'd have to say I am attracted to them, although I would never act on it. They both have kind of an easygoing quality to them. Sarah and I used to have that when we were younger, and I miss that. Everything is such a big deal now because we always have to be thinking about money and the business and the consequences of every little thing." When he said this, I noticed a new quality of attention on Sarah's face. This was exactly the kind of communication she was looking for from him. When he spoke to her from that deeper level in himself, he became the man she wanted to be married to, inviting her into the place where her dreams could be fulfilled. Here's something I've learned from many experiences of helping people resolve conflicts. Under the surface of most conflicts, you'll find that the warring parties are actually feeling the same deeper emotions. For example, two people may be locked in an angry conflict for weeks. When they finally get beneath the royal surface of the issue, however, they discover that the real issue is that they're both sad about something they've both kept hidden. They've been so locked into proving each other wrong that they haven't taken a moment to contact the true heart of the issue. Sarah and Jonah were living examples of this problem. Once I see people communicating about the deeper feelings, I know that it's possible for the miracle of rebirth to occur in the relationship. Now they're communicating as allies, not as enemies, and when people do that, real-life miracles are possible. Over the next couple of sessions, we worked on getting all those deeper feelings up into the light. There was sadness, and there were a number of fears they shared. They were afraid their lives were slipping away from them, swallowed up by all those long hours spent on the business, on entertaining clients, on designing and building their dream house, and all the other big-time demands of their big lives. Now, let's talk about discovering your story as your first step to wholeness. Earlier I mentioned that integrity is really about wholeness and completeness. An integrity breach occurs when we do something that separates us from the wholeness of ourselves or other people. To find these breaches and restore wholeness, we need to get good at asking questions like these. Where do I feel out of integrity with myself? What is keeping me from feeling whole and complete? What important feelings am I not letting into my awareness? Where in my life am I not telling the full truth? Where in my life have I not kept my promises? In my relationship with a certain person, what do I need to say or do to feel complete and whole? Questions such as these will lift you out of the limiting story that you've been living in. Almost all of us have a story about why we don't access our genius. When we're within that story, it's very difficult to know that it's just a story. What makes those stories seem so real and hard to recognize as just stories is that they were being told before we were born. We're born into stories that keep us from accessing our genius. We grow up among those stories and become like fish that aren't aware of the water they're swimming in. For example, in one family, the story might be that genius leads to irresponsibility. There might be a story about old Uncle George who left his wife and 7 kids behind to go off seeking his genius in the wilds of Fiji. He was never heard from again except in one tantalizing photo he sent of himself grinning like a loon in the company of a native dance troupe. In another family, the story might be that genius leads to madness. There's old Aunt Cicely, who retreated to her room in 1927 to write poetry and for the next 40 years could always be heard cackling and howling up there. In another family, the story might be that genius leads to poverty and decrepitude. Cousin Freddie spent his life trying to perfect an engine that ran on club soda and was forced to support himself in his old age by becoming a paperboy. These stories are passed down from one generation to the next to protect members of the clan from straying too far outside the confines of their zone of incompetence, competence, and excellence. Whatever your story is, the first task is to find it. Identify your family story of why you shouldn't access your genius. Once you've identified it, the next task is to lose your fascination with it. Don't give yourself a hard time for being fascinated with it. You were born into it, just like the rest of us. Just become more fascinated with the story of your big leap into the zone of genius. Gradually, this new fascination with genius will replace the unconscious fascination with the old program story. Now let's talk about the attitude I'd like you to take during these explorations. First, I hope you're not feeling overwhelmed by the complexity of the task. If so, remember that it comes down to specific things you do, none of which takes long in clock time. For example, it only takes 10 seconds to locate and acknowledge a feeling in your body, such as sadness or fear. It only takes a few seconds to communicate a specific truth to another person, a truth that can restore wholeness to a relationship that's felt incomplete for years. As you go about your discoveries, you'll benefit from adopting an attitude of wonder instead of blame. In other words, being light-hearted about noticing your upper-limit behaviors will help you make progress faster than if you criticize yourself for every little thing. When I maintain an attitude of cheerful wonder and keen interest toward my faults and flaws, I see them dissolve and transform much more rapidly than when I give myself a hard time about them. If you're willing to adopt a playful attitude toward yourself and your shortcomings, you can make extraordinarily rapid progress. It's easier to chuckle over things than to fret over them, and chuckling is much more fun for the people around you. Here's an example of lighthearted wonder. In one of my advanced groups for executives, some of the participants began referring to the upper limit problem by its acronym, ULP, U-L-P. They pronounced it as in gulp. One of the group's members said he remembered comic book characters saying ULP when they encountered something unexpected. Well, it didn't take long for ULP to catch on. Soon people were saying things like, "Boy, I had an ULP today," or "I caught myself in the middle of an ULP this afternoon." I encourage you to adopt this kind of playfulness toward all of your ULPs. An attitude of playful wonder is characteristic of people when they're operating in the zone of genius. For inspiration, I keep an autographed picture of Albert Einstein on the wall of my office. My wife gave it to me for my birthday some years ago. It's one of my most treasured possessions. The look of wonder in his eyes reminds me to keep seeking the deepest truths about life and to do my seeking in the spirit of play, not work. Here's what I recommend for daily action steps. These specific actions will keep you on track and on the fast track to living in your zone of genius. Make a commitment to keeping an attitude of wonder and play while learning about your upper limit behaviors. Say this sentence in your mind as often as you like. It expresses the attitude I'd like you to embody. Here's the sentence. I commit to discovering my upper limit behaviors and to having a good time while I'm learning about them. You can learn a lot more with a spirit of wonder and enjoyment than you can with an attitude of criticism. Also, make a list of your upper limit behaviors. Here are some of the most common ones. Worrying, blame and criticism, getting sick or hurt, squabbling, hiding significant feelings, not keeping agreements, not speaking significant truths to the relevant people. For example, if you're mad at John, he's the relevant person to talk to. It doesn't help to tell Fred that you're mad at John. Or deflecting. Brushing off compliments is a good example of deflecting. When you notice yourself doing one of the things on your upper limit list, such as worrying or failing to communicate some truth, shift your attention to the real issue, expanding your capacity for abundance, love, and success. Consciously let yourself make room in your awareness for abundance, love, and success. Use the resources of your whole being, not just your mind. For example, feel more love in your chest and heart area. Savor that body feeling, as well as the mental satisfaction of success and abundance. Embrace a new story that tells about your adventures in your zone of genius. Find a new mythology, or make up one of your own, that shows you enjoying your life in the full radiance of your expressed potential. Shortly, we'll explore how to live your new story. You'll see how to get beyond all the fears and spells that cause us to limit our potential. You'll know how to build a new foundation for yourself, a strong base from which you can thrive in your zone of genius. Now focus with me on building a new home in your zone of genius, how to make every moment an expression of your genius. Now let's focus on your answers to two main questions. What is my genius, and how can I bring forth my genius in ways that serve others and myself at the same time? If you have the courage to discover and bring forth your genius, you'll break through to unparalleled heights of productivity and life satisfaction. Discovering your zone of genius is your life's big leap. Everything up until now has been about hops, not leaps. Hopping, though it seems safe, is actually hazardous to your health. If you confine yourself to hops, you run the risk of rusting from the inside out. I know, I caught myself halfway through my life in the very act of rusting. There I was, hopping along in my zone of excellence, when suddenly I became aware of a dull and sluggish feeling deep within me. I couldn't figure out what it was at first. As I tuned into it, I realized it had been there for months, maybe years. I'd gotten to a place in my life where I could almost sleepwalk through doing all the things that kept me successful, writing books, giving speeches, coaching executives, teaching seminars. I did them and did them and did them, and the money kept pouring in. Soon there were employees, a big building, three houses, and an army of support personnel that needed to be fed. I remember well the day it all imploded on me. I got off the plane, exhausted from a grueling trip during which I'd given many talks and seminars, 19 cities in 21 days. I stopped by the office on my way home, and there I encountered glum looks on the faces of my accountant and my administrative director. They announced that taxes were due and that because of a cash flow shortfall, I needed to borrow $120,000 from myself to pay our taxes. I felt like a hunter-gatherer returning with a wild boar for the campfire, expecting high fives and a hot dinner, only to be told I also owed a couple of buffalo. I slunk home, dejected and irritated, and there I found that my garage door opener had died. Leaving my car in the driveway, I trudged out to get the mail. The first thing I pulled out was a big envelope emblazoned with this headline, "Congratulations on turning 50. Here is your free ARP card." I paused to digest the significance of this moment, and that's when I became aware of that sluggish, dull feeling deep within me. At first, I worried it might be a medical problem, so I started by getting a thorough workup. I discovered that I was in the best of health, except for 20 extra pounds of prosperity-induced padding, the effects of too many well-paid after-dinner speeches. Finding I was in good health meant I had to take a deeper look. And when I did, I found the source of my rust, and that discovery changed my life. The source was hidden in plain sight. It was the upper limit problem I knew so well. In spite of knowing a lot about it intellectually, I had gotten comfortably numb in my zone of excellence. So comfortably numb, in fact, that the upper limit problem had sneaked up and gotten me. Without realizing it, I'd worn such a comfortable rut in my zone of excellence that I'd overlooked the beckoning calls of my zone of genius. Fortunately, I got the message in time, and I want to make sure you do, too. We all need to be on the lookout for signs of our upper limit problem every day of our lives. It's a constant quest because we're always raising the bar on ourselves. The better we get, the better we want to be. Part of us wants very much to live in our zone of genius, yet at the same time, we're tied down by forces around us. The people around us want us to stay in our zone of excellence. We're a lot more reliable there. I just returned from a meeting that included a man and a woman who were both Harvard MBAs. Getting an MBA is a great achievement. It takes dedication, brilliance, and hard work. However, it's a hop, not a leap. You and I probably know plenty of brilliant, dedicated, hard-working people who hop through difficult hoops such as getting a Harvard MBA. You and I also know that most of them never made the big leap into their zone of genius. If you want to take a close look at this phenomenon, all you need to do is attend a class reunion. Not long ago, I gathered with a group of people who got their PhDs at Stanford while I was there doing the same in the 70s. The counseling psychology program was designed to train leaders in the field, so most of us took up careers as university professors or private practice psychologists. We were gathered to celebrate one of our professors, now retiring after a long and fruitful career. It was a festive occasion, fueled by goodwill, fond memories, and a free-flowing bar. After a few glasses of cheer, though, deeper feelings came pouring forth. The evening soured temporarily into a complaint fest. Out of a room full of 50 or so people, only a half dozen of us seemed to be genuinely happy with the way our lives were going. The professors in the group complained of sluggish bureaucracies and administrations that didn't support their research. They complained of pitiful salaries and the dire shortage of faculty parking spaces. The theme was, if it weren't for fill-in-the-blank, I could be doing what I really want to do. Now, the private practice therapists had their own set of complaints. Slow payments by insurance companies and the ever-expanding quagmire of paperwork. The therapists made a lot more money than the professors, so the therapists' complaints were flavored more by financial woes. They spoke bitterly of greedy ex-spouses, high alimony payments, long hours, ungrateful clients, exhaustion and burnout. The theme was, if it weren't for fill-in-the-blank, I could be doing what I really want to do. What was especially striking to me was that the professors envied the private practice people, who in turn were envious of the professors. From the professors' viewpoint, the private practice people had it made with their big salaries, plush offices, and absence of faculty meetings. To the private practice crowd, though, the professors were the ones with the cushy jobs. They got a steady paycheck, free office space, short hours, and plenty of time to write. As the evening wore on, I listened to one tale of thwarted hopes after another. Finally, I was jolted by an insight. None of these complaints were actually caused by pig-headed bureaucrats, lack of parking spaces, ungrateful clients, or anything of the sort. In other words, none of these brilliant, well-meaning people were upset for the reason they thought they were. Their complaints were all symptoms of not taking the big leap. From this perspective, every story took on a different meaning, and I began asking a different question in response to each person's story. After listening to a complaint, I would ask, if outside influences like money or insurance companies or bureaucrats were not a problem, what would you really love to be doing? And I learned a lot from what each person told me. First, almost everyone could tell me clearly what they'd love to be doing. Their answers included things like, I'd love to have time to write the book I've been wanting to write. And I'd love to create videos so more people could get access to the techniques I use. Or I'd love to have more of an impact in the world. What caught my attention, though, was the emotional tone behind those statements. Every time the person's face took on an expression of longing, tinged with hope, or burdened by despair. Longing is a persistent, lingering feeling of wanting something you can't quite get or something you've judged unobtainable. If you think there's still a possibility of attaining it, your longing is flavored by hope. If you think it's unobtainable, your longing sinks into a bog of despair. Longing was what I was hearing in every one of those conversations. Here's the other thing I learned that night. Most people have a carefully crafted, well-justified story about why they can't take their big leap. For one person, it was about the family. They said something like, "I can't possibly take the time to write or make a video, etc., because my family needs me." For another person, it was about stress. "I tried getting up at 5 a.m. for a while to work on my book," one of them said, "but I couldn't do that and do a good job with my 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. therapy clients." For others, it was purely about the money. "I can't do what I really want to do because I might not make as much money doing it." As I listened to these stories, I would sometimes hear the real fears emerge. There's a huge fear underneath every complaint. If I took the big leap into my zone of genius, I might fail. What if I really opened up to my true genius and found that my genius wasn't good enough? Better to keep the genie in the bottle and coast along in the zone of excellence. That way I don't have to risk taking a big leap and finding it isn't good enough. That way I don't have to risk discovering the ugly possibility that I don't have a zone of genius. Unless you're very lucky or very enlightened, you're likely to hear those kind of nattering voices and feel those nagging fears within you. They're part of the deal. I won't try to talk you out of them, and you shouldn't try to talk yourself out of them either. Just notice those voices and feel the fears. That's all you need to do with them. You don't need to rid yourself of them. Where would they go anyway? All you need to do is acknowledge them, wave to them, and let them know you're aware of them. Then get busy learning to live in your zone of genius. Now, here's your genius commitment. I'd like you to take a new step with me, one that will begin to anchor you in your zone of genius. Recall the questions I asked you back at the beginning of chapter 1? Now I want to ask you a new question that will turn on the turbojets for your big leap. I want you to make that big leap into your zone of genius. I've found an exhilaration there, a constant sense of purposeful joy that nothing else can compare to. In your zone of genius, you don't feel like you're working. Even though the time you spend there produces great financial abundance, you don't feel that you're expending effort to produce it. In your zone of genius, work doesn't feel like work. In your zone of genius, time feels completely different. Time seems to expand to support your activities. You have plenty of time to do what you most want to do. You'll learn more about this unusual phenomenon later when we talk about Einstein time. For right now, though, just know that in your zone of genius, time doesn't fly, it flows. So how about it? Will you make a commitment to living in your zone of genius all the time? If you do that, I can promise you as much real-life magic as you care to experience. In coaching people to discover their genius, I've found that it's essential to begin with a commitment to living in your zone of genius. Your commitment must come before you know how to make good on it. The image that comes to mind is from the third Indiana Jones movie, in which Indy must step out into thin air in a gesture of commitment before a bridge magically appears beneath his feet. The power of your commitment brings forth the means necessary for you to live in your zone of genius. If you will make a powerful, sincere commitment, a vow that you really want to live your life in your zone of genius, your journey will be blessed with uncommon good fortune at all the twists and turns of the road. Commitment has that power. I invite you to make your commitment right at this moment. Make a private deal between you and the universe, a formal commitment to living in your zone of genius. Here's the sentence I use when I'm working with people. I commit to living in my zone of genius now and forever. Repeat that sentence softly to yourself a few times, noticing how it feels to you. Then say it out loud a few times. Savor the different words and sounds of the sentence. For example, Say it a few times, accenting different words, like one time you might say, I commit to living in my zone of genius now and forever. Another time you might say, I commit to living in my zone of genius now and forever. When you're ready to make your formal commitment, speak that sentence from your heart as a formal contract between you and the universe. Now let's talk about the genius questions. Your sincere commitment is the entry gate to the zone of genius. Now that you've stepped out into the unknown, the bridge can appear under your feet. The bridge to your zone of genius is a set of questions to ask yourself. Actually, ask doesn't quite capture the flavor of how I want you to use the questions. I want you to wonder about them. These questions are designed to bring forth hidden treasures from deep inside you. Wonder is the tool that invites these treasures up into the light. To wonder about something is to explore with an open mind and an open heart. Wonder is defined as, quote, amazed admiration, end quote. So be sure to do your wondering with the attitude that your discoveries will be amazing and admirable. Here is genius question number one. What do I most love to do? What do I most love to do such that I love it so much I can do it for long stretches of time without getting tired or bored? What do I most love to do? When I was first figuring out how my own genius worked and how to get established in my zone of genius, I spent a lot of time wondering how to distinguish my genius from my excellence. I finally realized a big key to it. My genius is connected to what I most love to do. That's why I want you to wonder about what you most love to do. After wondering about it myself for more than a week, I began to get clear on what I most love to do. It's translating big, important, life-changing concepts into simple, practical things people can use. It's also dreaming up or downloading directly from the source those same kinds of useful, life-changing tools. I've never quite been able to figure out whether I'm incubating and launching those concepts myself or opening my gates to let in information from a different dimension. Perhaps it doesn't really matter as long as it turns out to be useful. Kathleen and I coached two women who were struggling in their corporate consulting business. They had both been successful on their own and had brought their businesses together to increase revenues and reduce expenses. The synergy didn't produce the desired effect, though, in terms of creating additional revenue, so they sought our counsel on what was holding them back. Rather than trying to figure out what could be done on the level of expenses, revenues, and other business-related items, we focused on love. We asked them, what do you most love to do in your business? Their answer revealed the problem and the solution. Rhonda and Cynthia both lit up at the question and told us that the main reason they had wanted to work together rather than separately was that they loved the spirit of play that each of them brought to their work. In their individual consulting practices, they had each become well known for bringing a sense of play to seemingly dull corporate seminars on budgeting and goal setting. They figured that if they integrated their businesses, a quantum enhancement of that spirit of play would bring even more success. After hearing this, we took a few minutes to examine their website and their slick, colorful brochure. The missing element was clear at a glance. Where is the spirit of play in your materials, we asked. The website and brochure were both beautifully produced and professional-looking, but they were devoid of any kind of playful aspect. Even their mission statement was worded in dull corporate speak. Rhonda and Cynthia suddenly realized that in trying to become more corporate and professional, they had left out their key ingredient. They saw that leaving the play out of their work had created an integrity glitch that was reflected in the lack of business. We suggested that they revise their website and brochure while they themselves were feeling a spirit of play. If they stopped feeling that spirit, we counseled, they should stop and come back to it later when they were feeling playful again. We heard later that their business had taken a healthy upturn after they put the play back where it belonged in their world. So enter the outskirts of your zone of genius by asking yourself what you most love to do. Wonder about it until you have a clearly forming sense of it in your body. You don't have to know it clearly or specifically yet. You just need to feel the glimmer of it in your inner world. Now, here's genius question number two. Let's render what I most love into something much more specific. Here's the second genius question I'd like for you to ponder. What work do I do that doesn't seem like work? You can do it all day long without ever feeling tired or bored. What work do you do that doesn't really seem like work? There's something at the very heart of the work you identify when you ask yourself this question. When you're doing this certain thing and not burdened with the pressures and irritations of running a business, you are at your very happiest. When you're doing it, you think, "This is why I do the work I do." I counseled an executive in his mid-50s, Bob, who had risen through the ranks in a major corporation a few months after his promotion to CEO. He came to me because, as he put it, "I haven't had a decent night's sleep since I took over the job. Something is wrong, and I cannot figure out what it is." So I flew out to Chicago to see if we could find out what was bugging him. Genius question number two turned the key for him. When I asked him what aspect of his work didn't feel like work to him, he told me that what he loved best was wandering around talking to other executives for 10 seconds or 5 minutes about whatever was on their mind. He said he got more done in these casual conversations than in formal meetings. Suddenly the light dawned. He said, "You know, I haven't done that a single time since I got promoted to CEO." The reason was partly logistical. He was now in a suite of offices that was separate from where he usually did his wandering around. He'd also been so inundated with new data that he'd spent most of his time trying to get it all into his head. He made a commitment to start wandering around again, and even did an hour of it while I was still there. I flew back home that night and heard the next day that he got a good night's sleep finally. If you're like most of us, you feel sad or irritated about the amount of your precious time that gets eaten up in the necessary trivia of your day. As you get more successful, it's common to feel a mounting pressure about this issue, an unnatural hurry-up that feels unhealthy to your well-being. I believe that the sense of mounting pressure is the call to live in your zone of genius. I've seen it disappear with miraculous speed when people opened up to wondering about what their true genius might be. If you're feeling any kind of that pressure, you've made it to the right place, and I'm very glad you did. Here's the third question I'd like you to entertain in that vast playground where your heart meets your mind. In my work, what produces the highest ratio of abundance and satisfaction to amount of time spent? So even if you only do 10 seconds or a few minutes of it, an idea or a deeper connection may spring forth that leads to huge value. By asking myself this question, I discovered that part of my genius is the free play of ideas in my mind. It's the ability to let ideas tumble and transform, free of criticism and censure, until something useful emerges. I've had projects where I've incubated and tumbled an idea for years before the fruitful outcome came forth, but I've also had experiences in which a few seconds devoted to free mind play have turned into millions in revenue. I never know exactly where it's going to lead to or whether it's going to lead anywhere at all. And that's part of the excitement of it, not knowing. And it may be that not knowing is a key ingredient in the success of the process. Over and over, I hear executives in fits of frustration give voice to complaints like this. "If I could just sit in my office and think for an hour without being interrupted, I could produce amazing results." In my own life, I don't make that complaint anymore, although I used to hear it come off my lips fairly often. For many years now, I've spent at least an hour a day meditating and letting my mind roam freely. Setting aside time to do this every day is a practical way to make good on my commitment to one of my highest priority activities. The answer you come up with may be entirely different, but I promise you, there is some essential aspect of the work you do that produces the greatest payoff. Perhaps it's connecting with your staff or your customers in a certain kind of way. Or perhaps it's simply picking up the phone and having a certain kind of conversation with a key person. Whatever it is, I want you to find it, and I want you to put the highest priority on doing some of it every day. In my own case, I've found it helpful to structure it into my day. This morning and every other morning for the last couple of decades, I sat down for a half hour of meditation and free mind play. I do that again in the evening. I do it before I engage in any official work such as email, writing, or project planning. To me, if something has the highest priority, it means I do it first. It takes a certain ruthlessness to set a priority and stick to it. For example, some years ago I worked with Nancy, a woman who had a burning desire to write mystery novels. She also had three kids, a husband, and a big commitment to activities in her church and community. Nancy had published one novel that did well enough to make the publisher want more, but not well enough for her to hire household help or a personal assistant. In our first and only session, I asked Nancy to describe how she spent her day. She told me that after getting her kids and husband off to work, she straightened up the house and took care of infrastructure stuff like paying bills and making grocery lists. Then she said, "If I've got any energy left, I sit down and write for an hour or two. If not, I might take a nap and then try to write for an hour or so before the kids start coming home." I summarized Nancy's priorities based on how she spent her time. Your family is your highest priority, right? She agreed. Your second priority is housework and infrastructure, and your third priority is writing. "No," she exclaimed. "Writing is much higher priority than housework and that sort of thing." I pointed out that if that were true, she would do her writing before she did her house-related things. And her reply was the key to resolving the whole issue. She said, "But I can't sit down to write unless I've got a clean house and things taken care of." "Sure you can," I said. "You just think you have to get that other stuff done first. Where did you get an idea like that?" She said, "But what if my husband came back from work and found a dirty house and me sitting up there writing?" "Well," I said, "he'd find a wife who put a higher priority on her creative expression than she did on keeping the house clean. Do you think he'd be upset about that?" "Not really," she said. "I think he'd actually like it." As our conversation developed, it became clear that she was holding herself hostage to housework for upper limit reasons. Nancy's unconscious mind had constructed a doom scenario of what would occur if she went all the way into her zone of genius. In her imagination, if she put her full attention into her writing, she'd neglect her family, and they would languish in the absence of her attention. Nancy began to see the absurdity of that way of thinking. She also discovered the real fear that was underneath it all, that if she made a big commitment to her creativity, she might fail on a bigger scale. If she stayed small, she could avoid the possibility of a big rejection. We covered another important chunk of territory in the session. Nancy also realized that she had a major fear of outshining her siblings. One of four girls, she had received mixed reactions from her sisters when her first novel came out. One sister had been thrilled and very supportive, while the other two showed various signs of jealousy and competitiveness. Her unconscious mind's solution had been to put the brakes on her creativity and let herself get consumed by housework and other pressures of daily life in hopes that the strains in the relationship with her sisters would disappear. I suggested another possibility to Nancy. Don't hold yourself back to keep your sisters from feeling jealous. Go all the way and inspire them with your full expression. "You cannot manage their feelings," I told her. "Their feelings are their business. They'd probably be just as jealous if you bought a new refrigerator, so you might as well go all the way and write a few bestsellers. That way they'd be jealous about something worth being jealous about. Or they might just go in a positive direction and get inspired to do something magnificent in their own lives." As we wound up our session, I gave her a homework assignment. For a week, Sit down and write before doing any of the household-related tasks. I told her, after you get your husband and kids out the door, force yourself to go up and write for an hour or two. Just break the pattern. Your mind may try to get you back in the old pattern. It might scream, no, 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 wash those dishes, put those clothes in the dryer before you write. If you don't, civilization will collapse. But just politely thank your mind for the unsolicited advice and then sit down and write anyway. Well, I never saw Nancy again in person, although she called me a couple of times to report on her progress. The task she'd taken on was not an easy one. She had spent many, many years being programmed to do things a certain way. In her growing up years, her mother had been a stay-at-home mom whose house was always spotless. It took her many weeks to get her literary life up to a higher priority than her domestic chores. There were more than a few days when she fell back into the old pattern. But over the next year, she was able to move her creative activities up to the place where they belonged on her priority list. Now here's genius question number 4. Take a deep breath and expand to embrace a new conception of yourself. The 4th genius question invites you to think of who you are in the most unusual terms. It asks you to identify a unique and priceless gift you carry within yourself. Your exploration into this aspect of yourself is not about self-flattery or expansion of your ego. It's a clear-eyed look at a deep innermost quality, with the intention of applying that quality to make your own life and the lives of others more valuable. Here's the question. What is my unique ability? Just ask yourself that. What is my unique ability? There's a special skill you're gifted with. This unique ability, fully realized and put to work, can provide enormous benefits to you and any organization you serve. We're in search right now of the deepest essentials. If you look into the essence of who you really are at your deepest level, you'll find a unique gift you've been blessed with. That gift is your greatest contribution to the people around you. It's the pinnacle skill of your working life. You can also use it to great benefit in your non-working life. The ability is not unique in the whole world, by the way. There might be millions of people who have it. However, it's usually unique in your particular circle or work setting. Do you know what your unique ability is? You may have discovered it already, but if you haven't, I'd like to show you how to find it. First, let me share with you an image I like to use. Have you ever seen a set of those little Russian dolls? When you open the big doll, there's a smaller one inside it, and then hidden within that doll, there's an even smaller one. Using that image, think of your unique ability as a skill within a skill within a skill. Here's what I mean. Your unique ability is usually camouflaged inside a larger skill you possess. You may not even realize that your unique ability is what's driving your success in applying the larger skill. For example, I didn't really learn about my unique ability until I was well into my 30s. I'd been using it all along, but it was like water to a fish. I'd taken it so much for granted that I didn't even really know it was a definable skill that could be described and refined. I knew I had a skill in helping people solve problems. I didn't get any formal training in therapy skills until I was 24, but according to a family story, I had an early leaning in that direction. I set up a cardboard box office in my grandmother's living room when I was a preschooler. I told my family that my job was to help people solve problems. According to the story I heard, I was very clear that I didn't handle medical problems. They could take those to an ordinary doctor. I told them I specialized in problems around the house. Since I grew up in a small southern town with no psychiatrists, psychologists, and such, I haven't got a clue where I might have picked this idea up. I should also mention that this first foray of mine into the consulting business was an utter flop. None of my family members ever took advantage of my services. In retrospect, I can forgive them for being reluctant to consult with a therapist who wore short pants and commuted to work on a tricycle. My unique ability occurs within the larger skill of helping people solve problems. The best way I can describe it is that I can be with people in a certain way that enables them to come up with creative solutions they hadn't thought of before. I can create a space that brings forth innovative solutions from inside people or from people I'm working with. I can actually feel this ability inside me right now. It's a feeling of respect for the creative process, coupled with a non-judgmental listening for something new to emerge. I can wait patiently as long as it takes for a new solution to emerge. Possibly because I'm willing to wait for as long as it takes, it doesn't usually take very long. Let me give you a real-life example of how this ability operates. I consulted once with the top two executives of a Fortune 500 company. They had gotten into a conflict about whether to build a new factory in South America. By the time I got called in, they had been at loggerheads for 2 weeks. The conflict had erupted into emotional displays that were unsettling to the other executives. The first thing I asked them was whether they would be willing to have a creative solution emerge from our conversation, whether it took 2 minutes or 2 days. They said they would be. So the second question I asked them was, "What do you think is really going on here?" This question confused them, and I explained that whenever a conflict had gone on as long as theirs had, there was almost always some other factor that was the real cause of the problem. They said they understood, but they had no idea what it might be. Here's where I put my ability into play. I said, "Then let's just wait and listen. Maybe something will emerge." We sat in silence for 10 seconds, then 20. One of them coughed. Then silence reigned again for another 20 seconds or so. Finally, the top guy said, "I feel like I'm losing control of the company. If we build this factory down there, it's goodbye to the company we started with. I'm an engineer. I like to walk through the R&D section and shoot the breeze with the engineers anytime I want to." The number two guy just sat there looking stunned. "Yeah," number one continued, "I used to be able to stand in the parking lot and see the whole business. I like that feeling. It was manageable. Now we're growing so fast, I see employees in the halls I haven't even met. It scares me." Finally, the number two guy said, "I get it. I couldn't figure out what was going on with you. Why didn't you tell me this before?" Number one raised his palms in a gesture of helplessness. "I didn't know it myself until a moment ago." A few minutes later, they came up with an innovative solution. Build the factory in South America as planned, but expand the research and development functions and locate them there at their present headquarters. That way, the head guy could continue his walk-arounds among the engineers and have the parts of the business he loved close to home. In business, especially these days, you simply can't afford to have those kind of conflicts go on for long. Conflicts cost money. They delay key decisions and turn speed to market into a molasses-drip morass. One reason for the conflict between my two executives was that they hadn't opened up to the kind of space between them that allowed a deeper communication to emerge. Once it came out, the problem was resolved quickly. Building the new factory became a business decision, not an emotional issue. A serendipitous event occurred while I was thinking about all of this. I caught the sounds of my two young granddaughters, Imogen and Elsie, aged 10 and 12 respectively, playing in the pool with one of their friends, all under the watchful eye of my Kathleen. To me, the sound of kids playing is one of the sweetest in life. The squeals coming from the backyard were so delightful that I left the quiet of my den and went to work out back so I could be closer to the action. It wasn't long before the girls swam over to the pool's edge and asked me what I was working on. I told them I was writing a book about the upper limit problem. Elsie and Imogen nodded because the upper limit problem has been part of their vocabulary pretty much since they were born. Elsie's friend Hannah asked, "What's that?" It gave me an opportunity to hear how a 12-year-old might explain it to another 12-year-old. Without missing a beat, Elsie said, If you don't know it's okay to feel good and have a good time, you'll do something to mess up when things are going well. I was typing furiously, trying to capture every word. Hannah asked for an example, and Elsie thought for a moment, giving my fingers a chance to catch up. Finally, she said, "You remember when we were playing dodgeball during recess last week, and that kid Frankie broke in and kicked the ball over the fence?" Hannah nodded. "Yeah, he does that sort of thing all the time." "Well," Elsie said, "he's got an upper limit problem." Grandfatherly pride aside, I think that's a pretty good definition of the upper limit problem. Sensing we were on a roll, I told them I was working on a section about unique abilities. I asked them, "What do you think your unique ability is?" I explained that a unique ability was a special gift, something you were really good at that was also helpful to people around you. I was searching for another way to explain it when Elsie chimed in and said, "It's like a superpower, right?" She referenced a movie in which the four superheroes each had a superpower they used to help in defeating the forces of evil. Imogen got it right away. "Yeah, like a superpower, only it's real," she said. Well, I couldn't have thought of a better way to describe it myself. So I asked the girls, "What's your real superpower?" Right away, Elsie said, "I can sense other people's feelings." "Wow," I readily agreed. Pretty much from her first breath, I've always found her to be one of the most sensitive, aware people I've ever known. Perhaps influenced by what Elsie said, the other two girls claimed similar superpowers. Imogen said her unique ability was knowing when people were angry but trying to hide it. Hannah said her skill was being able to tell if people liked each other. Recalling the dramas of life in junior high school, I told them I thought every one of those skills would come in very handy. Now let's go back to focusing on your own unique ability. I'd like you to be able to speak clearly and articulately about your genius. To do that, I've constructed an activity I use when coaching people on their genius. Here's a way to refine your understanding of your own innate genius. Recalling the image we used earlier about the Russian dolls, let's focus first on the outermost doll. This is the larger skill within which is hidden your innate gift. Anne is the 40-year-old CEO of a Silicon Valley consulting firm. When I asked her about her unique ability, she answered, "Running meetings." That was the outermost of the Russian dolls. Now we went one level further in. I asked, "When you're running meetings, what is it that you're doing when you're at your very best?" She thought for a moment, then said, "One thing is knowing when and how to gracefully cut off a discussion and move along." Well, that gave us a little more detail, but it still wasn't the essence of the skill. I asked her another question. "What gives you the ability to know when to do that?" She paused and reflected and then said, "You know, I've never thought about this before, but I feel an energy shift in the room and inside me. Something shifts in the room, and I know it's time to move on." Her face began to take on a glow as we discussed this subtler skill. That's one way I can always tell when people are homing in on their unique ability. Their faces reflect a sense of wonder and rapt attention. "Now that I think about it," she said, "I've been able to do that ever since I was a kid. It was a way to stay out of my parents' way when they were getting into one of their fights." She told me that she'd grown up in a fairly chaotic family with a father who drank too much and a mother who resented having to carry the extra weight of responsibility. The first place most of us use our unique ability is in navigating the tricky shoals of childhood. If you reflect on your unique ability, you'll probably find that it made its appearance early on in your life. You used it, probably without being aware of it, to cope with stressful situations and optimize your ability to thrive. My early life was an ideal training ground for a budding therapist and executive coach. My mother struggled with depression after my father's sudden death, and I spent much of my early childhood living with my grandparents. They were wonderful with me, but their relationship with each other was a different story. By the time I arrived on the scene, they'd been in a pitched battle for decades, characterized by constant bickering and periods of uneasy truce. I became a go-between for them in times